Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our medical nutritional update for the week, and we're sharing with you some stories that didn't make it onto our weekend broadcast. We're getting lots of callers, and we encourage you to call us during the program. And however, that sometimes pushes out some of the important stories. So here goes. Does meat cause colon cancer? Well, that's an important question. And it's actually a question that has been around for a really long time. In fact, when I was in medical school, there weren't a lot of nutrition courses at my medical school, as is often the case. Back then, this was in the early 1980s. Even now, reports are that the vast majority of medical schools only give you an hour or two of nutrition education. So I had to go around the metropolitan area. I was living in New York to find places where I could study nutrition. And I ended up at St. Luke's Hospital near Columbia University, my college alma mater, to spend a month with Dr. Theodore Van Itali, who is a pioneer in the field of nutrition. And as part of that experience, you know, I was a med student. They said, hey, you know, we're doing a study. And the study has to do with, is there something about the stool composition of meat eaters versus vegetarians and the risk of colon cancer? And so at the time, I was a vegetarian, and I signed up for the study, and I dutifully submitted a stool sample. And I have no idea what became of it in terms of the study results. The study was comparing the stool composition, you know, whatever, they did some kind of chemical analysis, probably wasn't as sophisticated as we now can do in 2017. Now we're also looking very carefully at the microbiome, the various bacteria that inhabit the gastrointestinal tract. We know it varies from vegetarians and plant eaters versus carnivores. But anyway, so that's a theory that's been around for a long time. And part of the problem is that, you know, when we look at epidemiology, we look at countries like, underdeveloped countries where they can't afford to eat a lot of meat, and they have a lot less colon cancer. But there's a lot of other factors involved in the development of colon cancer in industrialized countries. There's sedentary lifestyle. There's a lot of chemicalized foods. Sometimes the use of meat predominance in the diet precludes the intake of lots and lots of fiber and vegetables. Merely because a person eats meat doesn't necessarily mean that they don't eat lots of healthy fresh fruits and vegetables. I mean a fair amount of animal protein, but I also have huge salads and lots of fresh vegetables and plenty of fresh fruit. And it's possible that when you look at population studies where people eat a lot of meat and they get more cancer, it's because it's just happens that they're not eating enough fiber. So anyway, they did previous studies, meta-analyses that were published in 2013 that showed that red and processed meats are associated with increased risk of colorectal adenomas. Now, adenomas are benign, but they're polyps, and they're thought to be potentially a precursor to colon cancer. So here's a study, yet another study. This is 2017, June 2017, and what they tried to determine was whether meat causes polyps. And what they discovered was, in this large colonoscopy-based screening study, we showed no significant overall associations between red or processed meat consumption and the prevalence of any adenomas or advanced adenomas. So, okay, that kind of puts that theory to rest. And, you know, it's interesting here because sometimes I criticize meat studies because it shows that meat causes this, that, or the other thing, but they don't really distinguish between processed meat and grass-fed natural meat that we prefer people eat, processed meat, sometimes laden with chemicals, nitrates and other preservatives. And so the problem with some studies is that they don't differentiate between good meat and poor quality meat or meat products, such as hot dogs and bologna and sandwich meat and sausages and, you know, so on and so on. So in this study, it didn't matter. Is even processed meat was not associated with a higher risk for adenomas or colon polyps. So what I have to say is that if you follow a diet where you're just, you know, like a standard junky American diet, where you're eating tons of meat, and especially a lot of processed meat, to the exclusion of lots of fresh fruits and vegetables and perhaps whole grains and legumes, which is the way a lot of Americans eat. You know, they don't even know what a fresh salad is like, or, you know, the only bean dish that they might get is maybe, you know, a bowl of chili con carne here and there, or the chili that they put on their hot dog or their hamburger. And that is possibly associated with a higher risk for colon cancer. Although studies, they're very controversial. And if there is an effect of meat on colon cancer, it's not a very robust effect. Some studies say yes, some studies say no. This latest study suggests that there may not even be an association between even processed meat consumption and the risk of colon cancer. So, you know, certainly not a resounding affirmation of the idea that a meat-free diet will protect you against cancer. Certainly one of the advantages of a meat-free diet is, well, you know, the absence of meat, vegetarian diet, you're probably going to eat more fruits and vegetables, which is to the benefit of you, your intestinal milieu and the bacteria that inhabit it and the chemicals that they may secrete that could cause irritation to the intestinal wall and eventually trigger cancer. Okay, let's talk about protein and bone density. You know, one of our big themes here on this program is natural treatment of osteoporosis, and there's some wonderful natural approaches to osteoporosis. I'm really convinced that natural treatments outperform drugs in many respects without some of the safety considerations and side effects associated with drugs. Plus, when you use drugs, you often develop bone that seems artificially strong, that looks better on a DEXA scan, but ultimately is less structurally sound and brittle, causing what are called pathological fractures, which occur at seemingly at the slightest instigation after people have been taking medications like Boniva and Actonel and Fosamax for more than even just 4 or 5 years. It's thought that the optimal amount of time to take those is maybe 3-4 years. There's some benefits. Then you should get out while you can, because if you keep using them, and I've seen patients who've been on them for like 12, 14, 15 years, you can actually get weaker bone. But the role of diet has been an important consideration here. So what's the best diet for osteoporosis? Well, when I was a vegan, way back when, this is early in my medical career, when I espoused a macrobiotic diet, and also prior to and during medical school, I was a vegan. I was following a macrobiotic diet with lots of brown rice and tofu and no animal protein whatsoever. Of course, I was convinced that that was a superior diet. And the argument was that this was a beneficial diet for osteoporosis, because too much protein, so it was said, made the body acidic. And in an acidic situation, the body tends to leach minerals from the bone. So that was the dogma in that time period. And so we thought that this was the way to go. However, I have seen dyed-in-the-wool vegetarians and vegans who've had some really poor results on their bone densities. And population studies in countries where there's not a lot of protein intake, there may be benefits in terms of reduction of cardiovascular disease, in terms of degenerative diseases. But when it comes to bone strength, the results are not generally good. And so there's a new study. Actually, it's a meta-analysis. And it's in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, as many of the studies I've been citing today are. And it's entitled Dietary Protein and Bone Health, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis from none other than the National Osteoporosis Foundation, which is the big monolithic organization that talks to us and educates us about osteoporosis. And oh, by the way, there's a lot of sponsorship from the instrumentation industry, the people who make the scanners, and also the drug industry who make the medications. But, you know, they do some good work here because here they're evaluating the effects of diet. And what this big meta-analysis does, there are 16 studies, and actually 36 studies, 16 randomized controlled trials, 20 prospective cohort studies were included in the review. And what they concluded was that there was absolutely no evidence of an adverse effect of higher protein intakes. So this kind of puts to rest the argument that protein renders the body acidic in some way and pushes out calcium and other critical minerals from the bones. And oh, by the way, among the studies is an amazing study which looked at 82 patients who had acute hip fractures. Okay, so they already had hip fractures. And they actually had enough calcium and vitamin D, so that wasn't the problem. But then they were either supplemented with 20 grams of protein for 5 days per week for 6 months. And that was compared to a placebo, a maltodextrin placebo. In other words, you know, just kind of a powdered drink that made them think they were getting something. But when supplemented with 20 grams of protein, which is quite a lot, there was an increased concentration of something called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor, which is an anabolic growth factor for bone and muscle, at 6 and 12 months. And, most remarkably, the protein supplement also increased the femoral neck bone mineral density at 12 months. And that's pretty cool, because just 12 months of additional protein turned out to be real good for bone density. And presumably they measured it in the opposite hip, right? Because you can't, once you break your hip, you know, you can measure the bone density in the broken hip, you're going to get a funky result. So, and this is really significant. The median time spent in rehabilitation in the protein supplemented group, and these were mostly older individuals, right? You can imagine older individuals with hip fractures. 33 days in the protein supplemented group compared with 54 days in the placebo group. Now, you may say, you know, why do you need to spend 33 days in rehab when you have a hip fracture? Well, you just have a hip fracture. See, I was completely knocked out for months and months after my hip fracture at a relatively young age, at 53, and I was a trained athlete and in perfectly good health. So it's been shown that if you get a hip fracture, you are actually three times more likely to die within the coming year than comparable individuals without hip fractures. So it's a big deal. And the suggestion from this is that protein does no harm, and in fact may be beneficial for prevention of hip fractures. But also, if you get a hip fracture, make sure you get adequate protein, because it's going to help you with repair and recovery. Very, very essential. Because, well, people may ask, what does protein have to do with bone? Bone is just, you know, calcium and other minerals, right? Well, bone is living tissue, folks. And living tissue requires protein to synthesize collagen and the connective tissue and the blood vessels that make up this living tissue. It's a living tissue. It's not just dead chalk-like substance like the White Cliffs of Dover. It's an organ that requires a blood supply that has growing and remodeling cells. And in the absence of adequate protein, there's inadequate bone repair, restoration, and remodeling. And therefore, there is a potential benefit that might be gained by targeting a protein supplement intervention to high-risk subsets of the population. And I'm reading from the study. By targeting a protein supplement intervention to high-risk subsets of the population at risk for osteoporosis. So if you're having a lot of protein, don't worry about it from the standpoint of bone. If you're not getting enough protein and you have osteoporosis, up your protein intake. Even consider taking a protein supplement, maybe perhaps some hydrolyzed whey protein. And especially if you have a fracture, absolutely take a protein supplement to help get you back on your feet. This is a good point at which to allow one of our sponsors to share this message with you, so here goes.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to CarlsonLabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now back to our weekly medical nutritional update. Okay, here goes another study on food. You know, that's pretty relevant. You know, what foods help us live longer and what foods do us in. And dairy has a controversial relationship with health. And so I was intrigued by this study out of Sweden, which is entitled Non-Fermented Milk and Other Dairy Products, Associations with All-Cause Mortality. So, you know, fermented milk, that would be yogurt or kefir. And then there's just plain milk and butter. And then there's cheese, which is a fermented product. And what they found was kind of interesting. They found that butter was high consumers of non-fermented milk, greater than 2.5 times per day, had a 32% increased hazard for all-cause mortality. That's a one-third higher risk of dying compared with that of subjects who consumed milk less than one time per week. Wow. So milk, not great for you. All non-fermented milk types. The corresponding value for butter was an 11% hike in risk of dying. All non-fermented milk fat types were independently associated with increased health risks, but compared with full-fat milk, health risks were lower in consumers of medium and low-fat milk. Okay, so is it the fat that's causing the problem? Because full-fat milk, in this study anyway, seemed to be problematic. Well, no, because, interestingly, they found that fermented milk, even full-fat fermented milk, and cheese was associated with lower all-cause mortality. Okay, so it's not really the saturated fat, is it? And they're not sure what's going on. They speculate that there's a possibility that there's a microbiome effect of the beneficial bacteria that you get from yogurt with live cultures, potentially there are benefits from the vitamin K, or specifically vitamin K2 that you get in cheese, which may be responsible for what's called the Dutch paradox. The Dutch consume tons of cheese, but they actually have lower cardiovascular risk than comparable populations. But also that there's a lot of beneficial free fatty acids that may be good for the gut, and that some of these effects may be mediated by what's called the microbiome. So, interesting study. And, you know, some people really, and I do to some extent, ascribe to the notion that the secretions of the mammary gland are not really suitable for adult populations. Okay? They're designed for infants and baby animals, and once you're weaned, you don't need a lot of dairy. But sometime around, it's been estimated perhaps 8 to 15,000 years ago, humans began to develop the ability to drink animal milk. Before that, there was a high prevalence of lactose intolerance. And something happened. There was a genetic switch. There was some evolution. And it particularly happened at northern latitudes, perhaps originating in countries like Scandinavia, to enable people to retain lactose tolerance throughout their adult lives and be able to drink milk. And you'll notice that there's a high prevalence of lactose intolerance among darker-skinned individuals whose ancestors came from more temperate or equatorial regions of the world, the hot zones of the world. But in parts of the world where early animal husbandry and raising livestock began to develop as part of domestication of animals, that humans adapted to drinking milk on a lifelong basis. But something about milk, if it's not fermented, may ultimately be harmful. I was a little surprised to see that butter was also in that category, although to a lesser extent than milk, just 11% in the study compared to 32% with milk. Having lower fat milk reduced the risk but didn't entirely eliminate it. But when it came to yogurt, even full-fat yogurt and cheese, which, you know, gotta admit, is fattier than milk and, you know, perhaps close to as fat as butter, there was not that effect. There was, in fact, a protective effect of cheese products. So, you know, if you want to add dairy products to your diet, you're concerned about the health effects of the dairy products, you get a free pass when it comes to yogurt and kefir, and even cheese, and preferably not the processed kind. American cheese is not really cheese. It's kind of an artificial food, but real cheese may actually have health benefits, according to the latest study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Okay, folks, well, that's been fun, and it's great to be able to share some of the news of the week with you. And we'll do this from time to time here as some of the stories stack up on my desk here at Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Until next time, stay well.